may be seated. We're here on case 11-1501, State of Ohio versus Donald Billiter. For the appellant, Mr. Hardwick.
Thank you. And I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, please. This case involves a situation that's recurring in numerous courts across the state. The prosecutor fails to notice that a trial court has not imposed enforceable post-release control. As a result, that prosecutor does not avail him or herself of any of the remedies this court or the General Assembly has made available. The defendant then leaves prison and does not comply with his void post-release control and ends up pleading guilty to that void, to quote-unquote escaping from that legally non-existent post-release control. Well, the narrow question that this court has certified addresses, well, does res judicata bar that defendant categorically from demonstrating that he wasn't under detention and therefore is not guilty of escape from that void post-release control? And the answer must be that no, it doesn't. First of all, this court expressly said so in Fisher, where it said that void post-release control can be attacked collaterally at any time without regard to res judicata. That's just crystal clear language. But even more broadly, because this case actually does have some implications beyond post-release control, the state's theory is that once a defendant has pleaded guilty, even if it was an Alford plea and that defendant can come up with uncontrovertible evidence that he's not guilty, like a videotape or DNA that's unimpeachable, it doesn't matter. He should have raised it on appeal, or he shouldn't have pled guilty. He has to serve his prison term. And too bad. You're innocent. We don't care. Finish your prison term. That can't be the law, and that's never been the law in this state. The state responds with the general rule of res judicata, which, if there were no exceptions, would bar Mr. Billiter's claim. But as this court has recognized, even in the context of post-release control, both in and out of that, especially in Simpkins, res judicata will not be used so as to cause an injustice. And every
counsel, in this particular situation, just so I'm clear, the judge imposed an incorrect post-release control amount of years, 3 instead of 5.
Three discretionary instead of 5 mandatory.
Okay. So while your client was in prison, he had the 3 years hanging over his head. It's never modified. He is released from prison. The 3-year post-release control is never corrected, correct?
Correct.
And so it is your client then is found guilty of violating his post-release control and then sentenced, reincarcerated.
Well, reincarcerated. I don't think he was ever violated for the post-release. I don't think he ever received a post-release control violation. He was incarcerated. He was first given community control for quote-unquote escaping and then violated the community control and was sent to prison.
Okay.
And so to say that I've cited in my brief cases from a couple different other state Supreme Courts as well as federal courts of appeals that have all expressly held that a bona fide claim of actual innocence is an exception to the res judicata bar, and that a defendant who can make that high burden and prove actual innocence, and I'm not talking about, well, they can't prove it or...
But don't we just go back to the point where a valid post-release control sentence was not imposed before your client was released from the institution?
Correct.
And therefore, there is no valid post-release control sentence, component of a sentence, hanging over his head.
Correct.
So he couldn't have violated something that was not appropriately in place.
He was not under detention as defined by the escape statute, yes.
Okay.
And the state, in those cases, also make it very clear that, again, the defendant has to prove more than just they can't prove it or the evidence doesn't meet the reasonable doubt standard. They have to prove they didn't do it. One of those courts requires a clear and convincing standard. And I've also cited numerous cases in my brief where Ohio courts of appeals have been very proficient in denying and in affirming the denial of plea withdrawal motions where there was no legitimate basis. And as this court held in Davis, they can trial courts function quite well as that kind of gatekeeper. Well, unless there are any other questions, thank you. I'd like to reserve the balance of my time. Thank you.
Mr. Caldwell.
Madam Chief Justice, may it please the court. The procedural posture of this case is somewhat unique in the sense that what's been omitted so far is the fact that this defendant did raise this challenge to the improper imposition of post-release control after he pled guilty to the escape, after he was violated on the community control sanction, after he was sent to prison. The trial court denied that motion. He then appealed to the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals affirmed the trial court's ruling. And in that ruling, the court made three specific findings. The first was that the improper imposition of post-release control in the 1998 case did not render his sentence void. Secondly, because...
Why was that?
The court looked at this court's decision, Watkins versus Collins, and narrowly read the line of cases up to that point, and this was in 2004, that there was a difference between cases in which the trial court did not impose post-release control at all versus trial courts that had imposed it but imposed it incorrectly. And in this case, the Court of Appeals interpreted Watkins to put Mr. Billiter's case in the latter category and not the former, and therefore escaped the scope of this court's nascent PRC jurisprudence at that time.
But that has changed, and this court has ruled that post-release control sentences, if there's error there, the sentence is void, and the logic of the line of cases has been discussed and was discussed in this Court of Appeals case. We have this problem with the district courts of appeals taking different positions of how narrowly or how broadly this should be rendered. Originally, the sentence or the cases that were in effect before BZAC and that whole progeny of declaring certain sentences void, you would be absolutely correct. The defendant would not be able to raise this again. But because of BZAC and allowing the state to raise the issue of post-release control error beyond the 30 days, we now have this quandary that we're in.
I agree, Justice Lanziger, and you've pointed out numerous times in your separate opinions.
Oh, really?
But the initial Court of Appeals decision, again, applied this court's developing jurisprudence. This was before Jordan. It was before BZAC in a narrow sense and held that, again, the improper imposition did not render the sentence void. Therefore, the defendant was properly on post-release control, and therefore the subsequent escape charge, conviction, and sentence was not invalid.
And that's what you would like us to affirm today?
That's correct.
Which would go back to the way things were originally?
Ideally.
Ideally, exactly.
If you can get three more votes to agree with you.
So what you're saying is you want us to overrule, reverse the line of cases that we've developed.
Well,
with regards to errors in sentencing, mandatory components of sentences and their errors, revisit void and voidable, and allow the state to prevail.
Well, in an ideal world, yes, but I don't think you have to.
Yeah.
I don't think you have to reach.
All right, what's your second argument?
and again, Billiter 1 was decided. The very next day, this court came out with its Bloomer decision. And the argument on the appellant's side is Bloomer then undercut Watkins versus Collins, if not overruled it implicitly. It therefore undermined the whole basis of Billiter 1's holding in that case. unfortunately, Billiter did nothing with that case. He didn't file a motion to reconsider, to raise the Bloomer issue with the Court of Appeals. He did not appeal that decision to this court, arguing again that its Bloomer case undermined the Court of Appeals decision. Instead, he let that Billiter 1 decision hang out there and be the law of the case in this case. Then counsel picks Billiter up and files a motion to withdraw the guilty plea. And that's where we're at here in the peculiar posture of this particular case, because the trial judge, if you put yourself in his shoes, he's asked to ignore or overrule Billiter 1, a clear decision of the Court of Appeals in this case, and find that the original sentence was void, that therefore he was not on post-release control, and therefore the escape charge was invalid. And the judge in this case said essentially, no, I'm bound by principles of res judicata. Billiter 1 applies in this case. It's never been overruled. It's the law of this case. And therefore, I'm overruling the motion to withdraw the guilty plea on that basis. The appeal is taken up to the Court of Appeals, and in Billiter 2, the Court of Appeals essentially agreed with that rationale. I think that the posture of this case makes it a little different than the trio of cases from the Second District, in which you don't have this prior Court of Appeals decision in the case holding that the imposition of post-release control did not affect the validity of the sentence or the post-release control of the escape statute.
We have a conflict here with the Second District, am I right?
That's correct.
And how widespread is this problem? Obviously, we've got two districts involved.
Yes, the Fifth District has another case, which this court has accepted and stayed pending resolution of here, the Chandler case. And in that case, our Court of Appeals is much more strong by saying the defendant just can't sit there and not do anything during the course of the original case, never appeal or challenge the subsequent escape.
Well, actually, the defendant had a good reason to sit there in this case, because if he spoke up, he was going to get 5 years mandatory instead of 3 years discretionary.
Correct.
So what's his incentive to raise the issue?
At that time, he didn't have an incentive, and therefore, I wouldn't say his counsel was ineffective for going ahead and pleading and getting a community control sanction as opposed to a straight prison term. So there certainly were reasons for him not to do it.
So in essence, are you saying because of the subsequent developments of Billiter 1, the fact that there was not a valid post-release control sentence is waived?
You could use waiver language, yes, Your Honor.
Which, again, like Justice Lanzinger said, actually brings you back to the, if you don't appeal it within 30 days, you lose, which is not where we are in this line of in this analysis for courts failing to impose the correct post-release control. And then it's complicated by the fact that this was all discovered after the period of incarceration.
Correct.
Terminated.
Although our case has another layer in addition to your example there, in the sense that the issue is then raised, it does go to the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals decides that the claim doesn't have any merit. And therefore, that becomes the law of this case. And again, if you put yourself in the position...
Well, there were plenty of cases that came to us where the Court of Appeals said that the defendant's claim had no merit, and yet when we applied, you know, the cases that have been developed from this court, they in fact did have merit, and their post-release control portion of their sentences were void and unenforceable, or they were entitled to resentencing for that portion of the sentence.
But again, I'm unaware of any of those cases involving an appellate court decision which specifically ruled that what was done was not improper. which is what we have in this case. Again, the trial court's faced with this motion to withdraw and has an appellate court decision in its case saying that all the claims that are being raised in that motion have been decided and decide adversely to the defendant. And essentially, you're asking the trial court to overrule or ignore Billiter 1 and rule in favor of the defendant. And the trial judge in this case said, I'm bound by principles of res judicata. I'm not going to overrule the decision of the Court of Appeals in this particular case.
But, Mr. Caldwell, isn't the way the cases have been developed, res judicata has been weakened because of the idea of avoiding the saying that the sentence is a nullity or the portion of a sentence is a nullity? Then res judicata doesn't mean anything because you never had something to begin with. And the logic of it is what is the problem, because if it's good for the state to raise these issues, it has also got to be good for the defendant to raise the same type of issue.
I agree, Your Honor.
Right. Do prosecutors in Stark County attend sentencings?
Yes.
In the common pleas court?
Yes.
And do they have the opportunity to put input, such as to correct a mistake that a trial court could make?
Yes.
I mean, given the complexity of how you impose post-release control and all of the factors that need to be reviewed.
Yes. They have the opportunity to do so, and do so. I would note that the original conviction in this case was 1998, so it really predated all of the PRC cases that this court decided, and therefore nobody was really alerted to the fact that we should pay attention to this. I mean, I think the problem all starts that with the adoption of Senate Bill 2.
Well, you want to blame the legislature for this mess. Good move.
That trial courts, prosecutors, and defense attorneys looked at post-release control as analogous to parole. Mm-hmm. And with parole in the old system, the trial courts had no input. That was the exclusive province of the adult parole authority. So I think many of us thought, well, if it's akin like that, well, yes, we're supposed to put something in the judgment entry per 2929.19, but it's really something that's going to be taken care of by the APA. And so I think that's why sloppiness and inattention to detail crept in.
And then we had the Wood case that said the APA cannot impose post-release control unless it was part of the sentence imposed by the judge.
Correct. And that's one of the first cases that then starts the ball rolling.
Right.
In conclusion, therefore, we'd ask that this court answer the certified question in the affirmative and affirm the decision of the Court of Appeals.
Thank you. Mr. Hardwick.
First of all, this court has said in Fisher itself that law of the case is part of res judicata, and that law of the case, therefore, is not, it does not bar a defendant from claiming that post-release control is void. And I also want to clarify what the conflict is between the Second and the Fifth District. It is not over whether this post-release control was enforceable or not. The Fifth District, in its in Billiter 2, agreed with my position and held that his post-release control was void. That's in paragraph 13 of their opinion. Where the disagreement is in how to apply the res judicata bar. There is another dispute among appellate districts, in the 10th and the 6th District are on one side and everyone else is on the other, as to what constitutes void post-release control. Is it? But that is not.
Would you repeat that?
There is a dispute between the 10th with the 10th and the 6th District on one side and every other appellate district on the other about what constitutes void post-release control. And that's the 10th and the 6th District basically say any mention of it, kind of a close enough for government work position is what I'd like to call it. It's any mention of it's good enough to be enforceable. And the 2nd District and every other district has said, no. Bloomer says you have to have a proper sentencing entry. This court has in numerous cases said, I think Joseph was the most clear, where it said without the proper imposition of post-release control, the APA is powerless, and this court used the word powerless to impose the sanction. To say otherwise, to hold anything different would cause this court to have to overrule a huge line of cases. This court can easily, if this court decides to reach that issue, this court can deal with the problem. It's because the 6th and the 10th District are applying this court's line of writ cases, extraordinary writ cases and non-writ cases, the 2nd District very clearly, I think it said it best, that writs are different. A lot of times you will lose a claim in a writ that you will win filing something else. Writs are supposed to be hard to win. And that's why that case law is different.
Mr. Hardwick, following up on Justice O'Donnell's question about the presence of the counsel at sentencing, you also have the opportunity to correct or to make corrections with the trial judge for any misstatement regarding sentencing?
Correct, but at this point, post-release, as this court held in State X. Rel. McGrath v. APA, when the defendant has no post-release control, that's not the defendant's problem.
Exactly. There's no reason for right. you to come forward and say the mandatory time is such and such.
That's objection. You're not supposed to say, objection, Your Honor, please punish me more. and to address Justice O'Donnell's question, one thing that surprised me is that DRC is very open with giving out information about who their prisoners are, and I'm sure. And
who's very open?
DRC, Department of Rehabilitation and Corrections, and I've been shocked and surprised that prosecutors all across the state haven't asked for lists of all of their defendants serving felony sentences. All they have to do is go through them one by one and fix it, and at least going forward, they won't have this problem anymore.
And that could happen within 30 days of a sentence.
Right.
Easily, correct?
Correct. And for going forward, they can object or appeal. Going backward for people still in prison, they could ask DRC for a spreadsheet in Excel format. And we've gotten those in other cases. Spreadsheet in Excel format listing who their prisoners are from their counties. They just haven't done that. I think part of the problem is they haven't taken this seriously, despite this court's repeated admonitions. They just haven't taken it seriously.
If we were to say that you had 30 days to do this because that's the appealable time, there could be a potential of taking it more seriously than saying it's open-ended for infinity to go back and impose post-release control later.
Correct. And that's the position we asked for and lost in State versus Jordan, but I'm sure we'd be happy to resurrect that. But Agent Seltzer, it's the state who came to this court and ask that this be declared void ab initio. And I can't remember which of your honors made the statement, what's good for the state is good for the defendant. There are consequences to that decision, and this is one of them. Mr. Billiter is not guilty of escape. He wasn't under detention. When a defendant can, even if a defendant has committed other crimes, if the defendant can demonstrate that he is not guilty of something he has pleaded guilty to, that is a manifest injustice that should permit him to withdraw his plea.
Do trial judges, to your knowledge and the experience that you have, require written sentencing memos from prosecutors or defense counsel in cases?
Extremely rarely. In fact, I've never seen one actually required. Maybe in a cap. No, I've never seen one actually required. And at least on the defense side, it's rare. And I think even on the prosecutor side, it's rare. It'd have to be the exceptional case where something was very important. And it's exceptionally important. And I remember Your Honor asking the same question Your Honor asked the state here during the Bloomer arguments when there were three different prosecutors, if I remember right, all of them said that they didn't check the entries. Well, this is part of the problem. And again, as a result, and here the state also, here the state is
part of what we do, Mr. Hardwick, is to try to educate members of the bar as to some things that they could be doing to avoid bringing all these cases to us. And it doesn't seem to me to be overly complicated to have counsel attend sentencing hearings and help the court get the right entry signed. I mean, we have so many legislative requirements as to terms of incarceration and license suspensions and fines and post-release control with a whole myriad of other conditions. And as officers of the court, I think counsel have an obligation to assist the courts, don't you?
Yes, and combining the roles of zealous advocate and officers of the court, as zealous advocate, they're supposed to, but each side, as part of this adversarial system, is supposed to bring to the court's attention mistakes that mistakes that would benefit the other side. That's our adversarial system, and that wasn't that was not done in this case, and that was not done in the case. I'd ask this court to vacate Mr. Billiter's plea of guilty to escape, and discharge him from that offense. Thank you.
Thank you. We will take the matter under advisement, and you'll be notified of our decision.